And welcome to a very special episode of the Historic Present podcast, hosted by myself, Charlie Gordon, and my good friend, Jonah Howe. Jonah.
Hello.
Hello.
What makes this episode such a special one, I hear you ask? Well, we've been given the task by our school to create an episode of the podcast for History Enrichment Week. So for today's episode, we leave the 20th century, we leave Nazi Germany, we leave war-bound Europe, and we broaden out the picture. We were given the topic of social inequality. Now, throughout history, from the beginning of human civilization, there has always been some form of social inequality, some form of social injustice. From the slaves of ancient Rome and ancient Egypt to the frustrated peasants of France, the Nazi racial laws eradicating unideals during the 1930s and 40s, and the centuries of social injustice following the transatlantic slave trade, whose mark still leaves a sizable impact on society today. Social inequality leads to change, and change leads to history. To begin our look into some of the most striking cases of social inequality throughout history, we take a trip to Paris, the year 1783. Let's set the scene. We're in France in the early 1780s, and the current economic state is dire. France have a huge debt problem. A number of ill-advised financial maneuvers in the late 1700s worsened the financial situation of the already cash-strapped French government. France's prolonged involvement in the Seven Years' War of 1756 to 1763 drained the treasury, as did the country's participation in the American Revolution of 1775 to 1783. Moreover, in the typical indulgent fashion that so irked the common folk, mammoth costs associated with the upkeep of King Louis XVI's extravagant palace at Versailles and the frivolous spending of the Queen, Marie Antoinette, did little to relieve the growing debt. So that sets a clear picture of how economically crippled France currently are. Charlie, as the whole episode is about social inequalities and differences within society, talk to us about the structural system of French society in the 1780s.
Yeah, so at this point, the French society was split into a triple estate system. The first estate were the clergy. So these were the priests, the cardinals, the bishops, the men who were closest to God. They were in the top estate. They paid very, very little tax, and they made up only 1% of the population. In the second estate, we have the nobility. So barons, nobles, the royal family, people, aristocrats, everyone born into wealth. And in the third estate, we have pretty much 98% of the rest of the population of France, approximately 27 million people in this estate. So people in this estate varied from lawyers who did earn a fair sum of money through their own hard work. And, you know, there are people as well who are farmers and peasants who live in the countryside and really didn't have a lot of money. So, and this kind of system was very, it caused a lot of tension in France at the time, because a lot of the third estate felt as if they were kind of ostracized from, you know, high society, and they were kind of not really valued by the absolute monarchy that ruled France at the time. Now, the French royalty in the years prior to the revolution were, you know, a study of corruption and excess. France had long subscribed to this idea of a divine right, which maintained that kings were selected by God and thus perpetually entitled to the throne. And this sort of doctrine resulted in a system of absolute rule and provided the commoners with absolutely no input into the governance of their country.
So let's talk. You just mentioned government. Let's talk about what the political scene was like in France at that time. The French Parliament or French government had the name the Estates General or the Estates General. I'm not French. The Estates General was an ancient assembly consisting of the three different estates you so brilliantly outlined just there. So it consisted of the three different estates that each represented a portion of the French population. However, like you said, the bottom estate consisted of 98% of the population, whereas the top two estates had only 2% combined. Yet, despite the stark contrasts of the sizes of the estates, all three estates had the exact same size of voice when it came to parliamentary and governmental decisions. So Louis XVI, in this terrible economic situation, decided to convene in the Estates General. If the Estates General could agree on a tax solution, it would be implemented, because by this point, King Louis had come to the realization that if anything could solve the money problem, it will be through mass taxes.
Of the third estate.
However, since two of the three estates, the clergy and the nobility, were tax exempt, the attainment of any such solution was unlikely. Moreover, the outdated rules of order for the Estates General gave each estate a single vote,
Single vote. That's it.
despite the fact that the third estate, consisting of, like I said, 98% of the population, is so
Which
much bigger than the
it's
other
madness,
two.
because if he's the king's asking a question, saying, "Oh, okay, so should we tax the poor, the two estates consisting perhaps of 50 people each? The first two estates, they put their hands up. That's two votes, and the other thousand other thousand people who represented the third estate didn't put their hand up. The vote was 2-1 in favor of the first two estates, which meant that the third estate were to be taxed hugely, and the first two estates, well, mainly the second estate, the nobility, well, see, they didn't pay taxes, but they also lived this, as you mentioned earlier, this very extravagant lifestyle in luxury, and they really were not willing to give up their this lifestyle despite of the worsening financial situation in France. They were almost bankrupt following the Seven Years' War, and they just thought, we'll literally tax them for everything they have.
Yeah.
So window tax, poll tax,
Child tax.
soul tax, child tax,
Yeah.
land tax, everything tax. And it was just this and these kind of obviously these were very unpopular
Yeah.
for
So what we
19.
have is growing displeasement from the bottom rung of the French ladder of society, displeasement to the current society, as you would expect if such rigid rules of social inequality existed. So, as the peasants, as the third estate, were heavily, heavily taxed, increasingly taxed on almost everything, like you just said, and the fact that they received such little voice in parliamentary decisions, although they were the largest proportion of the population, they realized something. They realized that its numbers gave it an automatic advantage. They were 98% of the population. I keep banging on about that, but they were the largest part of the population. If they decided to do something, there couldn't be that much reaction from anyone else because they were so massive. The Third Estate declared itself the Sovereign National Assembly. This is a whole new parliament. And within days of the announcement, many members of the other two estates had switched allegiances over to this revolutionary new assembly.
That's right.
This new assembly stood for two main things: social equality and the destruction of the monarchy. By this point, Marie Antoinette and King Louis the 16th were some of the most hated figures in French society. And if I was Louis, I'd be a bit scared of.
Oh, definitely. As well as adding to that, Louis the 16th, is that right? He was a very, very, very poor ruler. I mean, he really did not have a clue about what to do. And his main financial advisors were just telling him to do things that would only help themselves. So we have a fairly irresponsible ruler at the helm at this point in a time of such disparity socially and economically. And at this point, the people were starving. They were hungry. And bread was becoming scarce. And of course, the nobility, they had all the bread one could ever want, with the other 98% of the population starving. So what we can kind of infer from this is that, you know, why couldn't they just have a revolution?
Well, we're not there quite yet.
No.
The French peasants, the French Third Estate, are becoming increasingly more and more fed up of the current social injustice they are on the receiving end of. They want an end to it. And shortly after the National Assembly formed, its members took the Tennis Court Oath. Now, it's called the Tennis Court Oath because they were forced to sign it in a tennis court after King Louis went and locked up the building in which they had previously used for meetings, as Louis was beginning to get a little bit scared of what was going on. So anyway, its members took the Tennis Court Oath, swearing that they would not relent in their efforts until a new constitution had been agreed upon. Social inequality, like I said, leads to change. And this is a prime example of people fed up of being pushed to the bottom and pushing for change. The National Assembly's revolutionary spirit galvanized France, manifesting in a number of different ways.
Although many accounts of the French Revolution focus on the French peasantry's grievances, such as rising food prices, disadvantageous feudal contracts, and general mistreatment at the hands of the aristocracy, these factors actually played a limited role in inciting the revolution itself. And for all the hardships they endured, it wasn't the peasants who jump-started the revolution. Rather, it was the wealthy commoners, the bourgeoisie. So these guys, middle class, they are still considered to be members of the Third Estate. And they objected mostly, most vocally, to the subpar treatment they were receiving. So now, obviously, the bourgeoisie were generally hard-working, educated men who were well-versed in the enlightened thought of the time. Obviously, at this point, the philosophical age of enlightenment. And although many of the wealthier men had more money than some of the French nobles, they lacked the elite titles and thus were subjected to the same treatment and taxation as even the poorest peasants, which is something they found to be outrageous, because these guys, you know, they worked hard, they went to university, they, you know, completed school, they just generally were hardworking people. And it was the bourgeoisie that would really act as a catalyst for the revolution. And once they started to act, because these guys sort of knew the justice system and they were quite, you know, well-educated, as I said, they could speak well, they were able to articulate their opinions very well. So once they started to act, the peasants were soon to follow in their masses to try and bring down this monarchy.
Okay, let's get on to the actual revolution then itself. So we've outlined growing hatred towards those benefiting off the social inequality in France. And as you can imagine, as you probably know, the peasants and those at the bottom of French society aren't going to take it that way. So they revolt. In Paris, citizens stormed the city's largest prison, the Bastille in pursuit of arms. In the countryside, peasants and farmers revolted against their feudal contracts by attacking the manors and estates of their landlords. Dubbed the Great Fear, these rural attacks continued until the early August issuing of the August Decrees, which freed those peasants from their oppressive contracts. Shortly after, the Assembly released the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen, which established a proper judicial code and the autonomy of the French people. So what we've seen there is what can come as a result of social inequality. If people are pushed to the edges of society, if people are pushed right down to the bottom rung of the societal ladder, they will march for change, and the French Revolution is a prime example of that. Since the French Revolution, France has been a republic free of the monarchy. Social injustice, as seen in the French Revolution, led to a short period, let's say, of justice itself. So there, with the French Revolution, we've looked at how social inequality drives anger and eventually leads to change. We're going to jump forward a century or so to America at the start of the 20th century. Now, back then, the US society had nowhere near as a rigid societal pyramid as France did in the 1780s. The US Constitution states that everyone is equal. But as we will begin to look at, many groups in America were not treated fairly. There was a great deal of prejudice against those who were not considered real Americans. And this leads us on to our second case of social inequality throughout history. So Charlie, I'm going to hand over to you. Talk to us about the social inequality experienced by many Black communities and Black people in America, still very much existing to modern day 2021 USA.
Yeah, so at this point that we're looking at the moment, we're sort of looking at the 1920s, so 1920 to 1933, generally. They faced a lot of problems, Black Americans. At that point, in 1920, there were 12 million Black Americans living in the USA, with 75% of them living in the South, where racial intolerance affected every aspect of their lives. So let's just for a second talk about the experiences of Black Americans in the Southern states. And although slavery had ended in 1865 under the Emancipation Proclamation signed by Abraham Lincoln, Black Americans in the Southern states suffered more discrimination than those in the North. And this was because of the Jim Crow laws in the South. So the Jim Crow laws legalized segregation and helped keep Black Americans in inferior positions, society, politics, and the economy. So, Joan, let's discuss some of these Jim Crow laws.
So the Jim Crow laws implemented legally defined and outlined social inequality in America. These laws, purely racist in a word, meant that white and Black Americans had to live separately. The areas affected by segregation included churches, hospitals, theaters, schools, cemeteries, parks, and even toilets. They went on. Jim Crow laws stated that Black Americans could not serve on juries. Jim Crow laws stated that schools for Black Americans were to be deliberately kept inferior so that they would remain uneducated and not advance in society. The authorities would hence spend less on Black American schools than those for white people. Textbooks were rare and class sizes were huge. Voting was also made difficult for Black Americans.
Yeah, so yeah, you mentioned voting there, Jonah. There were a couple of things that that the system did to make it difficult for Black people to vote. So there was a poll tax. So you know, due to the low wages many Black Americans received, they were too poor to pay the tax. Therefore, unable to vote. Also, you had to pass a literacy test. People had to prove that they could read difficult extracts from texts, but literacy levels were low amongst Black Americans, so few were allowed to vote. And even when some of them were able to pass the tests, they were attacked and threatened if they tried to vote. And as well as that, the grandfather clause excluded anyone whose grandfather was a slave from voting. Employment was also affected, and Black Americans were forced to work in low-paid, unskilled jobs, such as on farms and a lot of other jobs that involved manual labor. And the majority of them were not able to benefit from the flourishing economy of the 1920s, the Great Boom, as we call it, which heavily affected Weimar Germany, as we saw earlier in the earlier episodes. And most Black Americans in the South were sharecroppers who suffered when agricultural prices fell through the late 1920s, following the Wall Street crash and into the early 1930s. And 75% of, I don't know, 750,000 lost their jobs. And social customs emphasized the inferiority of Black Americans in society. So they had to enter a white person's house by the back door, not look them directly in the eye or speak before they were spoken to. I mean, there's so much to talk about in terms of these laws, the amount of injustice Black people faced throughout this time period, and as they still do today. And we have to, in order for us to sort of understand what's going on today with BLM and what happens with racial injustice, especially in America, also in Britain and other countries, we have to really look at these laws, and we can see how that they are still in effect. Well, not in effect as such, but the legacy of them still lives on today.
So you've given us, and we've gone through what the Jim Crow laws stated. They legally made the lives of Black people of America harder. This is where social inequality really booms. You know, you use that word. This is where social inequality hits its nasty, infamous peak in America, as you have a completely split, a completely segregated society between people purely based on the color of their skin. We looked at the French Revolution and the reaction of French peasants to the problems they faced. They grouped together in their masses, in their large majority, and they forced a change through violence, through uprising, through revolution, and it worked. Now let's look at the reaction of Black Americans to the problems they faced. In terms of culture, they expressed their frustrations at discrimination through their music and literature. Their culture flourished in the 1920s, especially in inner city areas like Harlem and New York. Music such as jazz, soul, and blues became popular. When jazz was banned in a number of cities, performers moved to the speakeasies. Thus, young white people were influenced by Black American culture. Their theaters attracted big audiences. Comedians, actors, and dancers such as Josephine Baker had very successful shows. You might have heard Louis Armstrong, a very successful and famous musician. In terms of politics, some joined Black American political organizations to express their frustrations. There were two main groups in the 1920s. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, was led by William Du Bois and grew rapidly and had 90,000 members in 1919. It wanted to take action. It wanted to go to the political picture and make Black Americans more aware of their civil rights, make them more aware of how society was treating them unequally, and campaigned for the abolition of segregation, the right to vote, and equality in education. They used legal action and non-violent activities as a way of improving the lives of Black Americans. This is a stark contrast, Charlie, to the reactions of French revolters and their response to social inequality. But as Black Americans start to refine their culture and see an almost unification and a sense of togetherness, there is the rise of another organization who seriously wants that return to a time when Black communities and Black people of America and their voices were muffled or preferably silent altogether. This organization being who, Charlie Gordon?
The Ku Klux Klan, the infamous KKK, which was a racist group which began in the southern states at the end of the American Civil War in 1865. And it was revived in 1915 and grew quickly. So in 1921, it had over 100,000 members. But by the mid-1920s, the movement was at its strongest with 5 million members. 5 million members. Only white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, WASPs, could join, and they believed in the supremacy of white Protestants who were native to the USA, i.e. the original immigrants to America. And the KKK initially discriminated against Black Americans, but in the 1920s, it also attacked and terrorized Roman Catholics, Jews, new immigrants, communists, and socialists. So this is kind of, you know, a far-right group like we see at the moment, the alt-right, for example, in America. And it also extended the geographical area it operated in to cover the entire nation, not just the South. So in the North as well, in order to create a more racist culture. And it expanded its political influence into key positions, including the governorship of Alabama. So there are obviously a few reasons for the KKK's growth in the early 1920s. The KKK's emphasis on morality was attractive to many. So, for example, a lot of people were worried by women smoking and drinking in public or wearing shorter skirts and visiting illegal speakeasies. It's exploited racist attitudes held in small towns in both the North and the South, and it played on people's fears that mass immigration might lead to unemployment, communism, corruption, alcohol abuse, and un-American modern ideas, I suppose, you know, very traditionalist kind of thinking that the KKK had.
Charlie, how did the KKK affect and contribute to social inequality, and how did it make the lives of Black Americans that much worse?
Yeah, so the KKK became very well known for many different activities that included holding nighttime meetings, burning crosses, and marching in white clothing with a Confederate flag on it, with hoods over their heads, violently attacking minority communities, throwing tar and feathers, raping, murdering, lynching, which were mob killings of Black Americans without trial, known as the rope law. And in the state of Georgia in 1924 to 25, 135 people were lynched. And in total, over 400 Black Americans were lynched by the KKK in the 1920s. So let's just digest that for a moment.
It's over 400. Brutal.
Brutal.
And ruthless, horrifying.
Murder. Oh, yeah. I mean, these are scores of people coming up to Black people and just putting their head inside a rope and hanging them, and just because they're Black.
The means of the color of a person's skin, not by the decisions they've made, the actions they've done. It's no one's born racist.
No, we can all agree that.
Initial response of fear to something that's different. And the KKK really amplified
they just played on that
injustice problems in America.
They just played on that fear. And also, I just want to mention one specific case I do remember doing in year eight history with Mr. Hardy. We discussed the lynching of Emmett Till, a young 15-year-old Black boy who just because he spoke to a woman, a white woman, who was the wife of a shop owner, was lynched because of it, and the shop owner ordered the KKK on him, and he was lynched brutally. So that's just an example of a very famous case of those lynch mobs. But obviously, at this time, it was very, very common, and people just allowed it. It was very much something that people were comfortable with. A lot of people, even if they weren't themselves, personally being racist, they just let it happen. They didn't speak up against it at this point. But obviously, we won't go through this today. But this paved the way for the civil rights movement in the 1960s, headed by Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, who were instrumental in achieving equal rights for Black people across America and the world as well.
I want to draw a comparison between changes in French society and changes in American society. In the French Revolution, like we discussed, the change came as a result of revolting and of violence because of the majority number of the people affected by social inequality. And they knew that if they took to the streets with weapons and stormed buildings such as the Bastille, changes would come about. But that couldn't have been the same in America because of the fact that Black people in America were still very much a minority. And so what they had to do, like we've said, they had to express their frustration, certainly in the earlier years of the 1900s, through culture, through arts, through politics. And then, as it became even more and more unbearable, through organizations purely built on racism and hatred, such as the KKK, change had to be made. And Charlie, like you said, the civil rights movement paved the way for the end of social inequality.
Well, legal social inequality.
Of course, it's harder to change people's attitudes. Once again, this shows that social inequality is not going to last forever. And it didn't in France, it didn't in America, legally, because of the will of people to stand up, to take action and do what's morally right.